Welcome to the Project Sleep Podcast. For those of you who've listened before, you might be expecting to hear from Julie Flygar, Project Sleep's founder and CEO. But for this special series of podcasts on sleep apnea topics, I'll be your host. I'm Emma Cooksey, the Sleep Apnea Program Manager here at Project Sleep, and I'm so glad you're here. Project Sleep is a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to raising awareness and advocating for sleep health, sleep equity, and sleep disorders. We created the Sleep Apnea Squad series to allow listeners to dive deeper into specific topics relevant to living with sleep apnea. For more on today's topic, please check out our corresponding toolkit, which is available for free on our website to download, print, and share. The link to the toolkit and other Sleep Apnea Squad topics is in the show notes, or you can find the Sleep Apnea Squad page at project-sleep.com. On this podcast, all guests express their own opinions. While medical diagnoses and treatment options are discussed for educational purposes, this information should not be taken as medical advice. Each person's experience is so unique, which is why it's so important to consult your own medical team while making decisions about your own health. If you haven't done so yet, please hit the subscribe button so you never miss a Project Sleep podcast episode. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please leave us a rating or a review wherever you listen so that we can reach more listeners and raise more awareness. So without further ado, here's today's Sleep Apnea Squad episode. Welcome, everybody, to our first broadcast in the Sleep Apnea Squad series. So today we're going to be discussing, could I have sleep apnea? And we'll be learning all about the signs and symptoms of sleep apnea and just a little bit about some of the barriers that are there for people who are seeking this diagnosis. So I'm really excited to welcome our guests. We're joined today by two really great guests. So first of all, Bob Feil. Bob is a former Major League Baseball player. So he played at Jefferson University, where he was one of only four Rams to have his jersey retired by the school. He was drafted in Major League Baseball to the Toronto Blue Jays, where he played 3.5 seasons. And in his career after baseball, he has been working in IT and computer science. So he's now the Senior Director of Solution Engineering at Ledger Run. So hi to Bob, and he's going to be sharing a bit about his journey to diagnosis with obstructive sleep apnea. And then next we have Dr. Sam Kashani, who is a board-certified sleep medicine specialist at UCLA. He completed his residency at Arrowhead Regional Medical Center, where he worked with medically underserved people, and followed that with a fellowship in sleep medicine at UCLA, the David Giffen School of Medicine. He's the president-elect of the California Sleep Society, and he's an enthusiastic member of our Project Sleep Expert Advisory Board. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about what we're going to, like an overview for today. We're going to talk a little bit about symptoms of sleep apnea. I think oftentimes people have a tough time noticing or recognizing symptoms in themselves of sleep apnea. So we're going to talk all about how those show up and how they show up differently among different people. We're going to talk a little bit about unhelpful stereotypes, which still persist around sleep apnea, and I think sometimes prevent people from going to their doctor because they think, well, this isn't something that I could have because, you know, I don't fit certain stereotypes. So hopefully we'll shatter those today and everybody will understand that this can really affect anyone. And if we have time, we're going to just touch on advocating for yourself in medical settings. So I think sometimes, you know, primary care physicians and GPs aren't necessarily very well trained in sleep. And so knowing how to advocate for yourself can be really helpful. So I'm going to start with Sam. And so I wondered, Sam, if we could just start by explaining the difference between central sleep apnea and obstructive sleep apnea. I know that today we're going to talk a lot about obstructive sleep apnea, and it is the more common type of sleep apnea that Bob and I both have. But I thought just for people watching, it would be great to set the scene, you know, and kind of explain the difference between those two.
Great question. So First of all, I think it's important to, you know, when you're describing differences between these two types of sleep apnea, obstructive versus central, is what is sleep apnea to begin with? Because sleep apnea, whether it's obstructive or central, is still sleep apnea. So the simple way that I like to always describe it to patients is whether it's obstructive or central, all sleep apnea is in one sentence. All it represents is essentially when a person is asleep and has lots of apneas. And then, of course, we get into the definition of what an apnea is, or a respiratory episode, or an apnea episode is. But specifically, the difference between OSA and CSA is really the cause. So again, in both scenarios, the person is having apneic episodes during sleep, but for different reasons. In obstructive sleep apnea, there's actual obstruction or blockage in the throat or the upper airway. And it's because of this blockage that the person is having these brief spells or brief episodes of paused or shallow breathing. Whereas with central sleep apnea, there's not necessarily an obstruction in the throat, but you can think of it as faulty signaling between the brain or the central nervous system and the breathing muscles. And usually there are causes, very often many of them neurologic, but there's also non-neurologic causes like congestive heart failure, for example, or atrial fibrillation. So essentially saying that rather than having a blockage in the throat causing these brief episodes, once again, faulty signaling between the brain and the breathing muscles. And symptom-wise, there's a lot of overlap, but there's also some differences to keep in mind in the differences between these two types.
Yeah, and I think when we start on the symptoms, we can speak a bit to that, about the difference. So Bob, I just wanted to come to you and ask a bit, like, looking back, when did you first notice symptoms in yourself around your sleep, or maybe sleepiness during the day, where, you know, you first thought there might be something going on? Do you want to just share it with everybody about that?
Yeah, it was kind of an interesting situation for me because I've been, you know, pretty fit my whole life, being an athlete and being kind of the non-stereotypical, you know, OSA candidate. I started noticing those symptoms probably about 3 years ago. At least ones that I became aware of, where, and they weren't your typical symptoms. Like you might have mentioned earlier, like loud snoring. I'm not a snorer. I never have been. Sleepiness during the day, not so much. But then again, I would just power through days anyway, just being the athletic mindset I had. For me, there was two key symptoms that kept creeping up, and I had no idea. Was frequent urination during the night, like getting up 3 or 4 times. Like it became so like inconvenient that I was like, what is going on? And then the other one was night sweats, like extreme night sweats. And ultimately, those were the two major symptoms that made me start exploring some things, because I get my blood work done regularly, like every 3 to 6 months for the last 5 years. So I was on top of some things. And there was a couple markers in blood work that I don't know. And Dr. Kishani, you could probably touch on this. So my hemocrit and hemoglobin were elevated. And once I saw that, I mentioned to you, Emma, in the past that I had a couple pulmonology friends of mine that I can talk, just like call up. And they were like, you should get a sleep study, my one friend said. And I was like, sleep study? I'm like, they have to go into a lab and sleep overnight. I'm like, I'm the latest sleeper. That will be terrible. And he said, there's options for at home now. I thought about it for a while. But those symptoms, going back to your question, those symptoms, those were the two main ones. The frequent urination, which became a headache. That was the big one. And then the night sweats, of course, which is just more of an inconvenience. And then the blood markers. Those were, but not your typical loud snoring, you know, gasping and waking up gasping. I didn't have any of those that I was aware of. So that's what kind of prompted me to do an at-home sleep study.
And so when it came to, I think sometimes with sleep apnea, it can be a bed partner that's actually, you know, picking up on some of these things. Was that true for you? Like, did your wife notice anything at night, or?
No. I mean, not really. Besides me just getting up, and then we would always chalk it up to, well, you're getting older. But I'm like 45 at the time. I'm like, I don't know about this. And I've been always, you know, one of the things I've always said, or even my parents say growing up, you're such a light sleeper, which what I'm finding out is that really a thing? Maybe in some different areas, but maybe I'm just, you know, waking myself because I'm not breathing. I'm
a terrible breather. So you're saying that, so during childhood, people, mm-hmm. like you were talking about being a light sleeper. So how did that show up in your life? Like, were you down at night, or what happened?
I mean, a lot of things, especially being in athletics, because being and getting some endurance things like VO2 max and things like, for the amount I trained and how hard I trained, something that didn't correlate. It was always really hard for me to do any type of endurance activities, long distance running, long distance cycling, things like that. And the one thing I can say, once I was treated for sleep apnea, I mean, my endurance has gone through the roof in terms of just being able to just up my VO2 max, like incredibly. But yeah, I mean, the light sleeper, I mean, every little thing I would wake up, every little thing. I mean, even being treated, it's still, I've gotten so much better just, you know, really dialing things in the past year and a half. But yeah, that was the big thing, the light sleeper thing, whereas, you know, the multiple arousals, like everybody wakes up during the night, but waking up and knowing I'm awake and just being startled a lot. And it was just, you know, it's all textbook things now that I know. But I think symptom-wise for your average individual, I mean, it's got to be hard for someone like Dr. Kashani's job, because the amount of patients that you have that are elderly or older, and I don't know if we'll get into it in this episode, but the amount of logistics involved in getting a machine and getting it set up and getting into a routine is so complex. And I'm a tech person, and I'm a pretty bright guy. And the beginning was such a rough time. And I just feel for all the patients out there that are just on edge. And that's why I love Project Sleep. I've learned so much. I pass it on to tons of people just because they think stereotypically CPAP and sleep apnea is for obese people only. That's it. End of story. And they just don't understand.
You'd mentioned your pulmonologist friend. So I'm really interested mm-hmm. in what you thought when your friend mentioned you should get a sleep study. Like, were those the things going on in your mind? Like, it's older people, it's not fit younger people that have this.
I mean, for me at the time, which was almost 2 years ago now, I wanted to do anything for resolution of getting up. When he said it could solve those things, I was like, I'll try anything. You know, I'll try anything. Why not? It's not like it's a medication I have to take every day, which would be fine. But it's something where, okay, machine on your face. I can adjust. I have the discipline to do anything. And yeah, that was a whole challenge in the beginning as well. But I think ultimately just for symptom resolution and for long-term health, the more I read about it, the more I understood it. I mean, I've done a ton of research now. Now I'm pretty well-versed. But early on, it was a little daunting. It was like, wait, it can cause all this. Like high blood pressure. That was another symptom. My blood pressure shot up too. And I had never had high blood pressure. And that's one thing where I started to see, and I had a child about 4.5 years ago. So it changed my perspective on life and everything in terms of my health and being around longer. So anything for longevity. So I looked into it and, you know, things have worked out now. I mean, the first couple of months were brutal, but yeah.
Thanks so much for sharing your experience with us, Bob. I appreciate it. I just kind of wanted to contrast that against my symptoms, because mm-hmm. I think sometimes we're going to go to Sam next to kind of talk through what some of these symptoms are. But I think that it's quite striking the difference, right? So I went undiagnosed with obstructive sleep apnea for about 10 years. And during that time, a lot of the symptoms that I had, and the main symptom I had was anxiety and depression. So when I was going to doctors, I had daytime sleepiness that was really significant, that was affecting my work and was affecting me, like being able to stay awake. And, you know, my first job out of college, I remember sitting in meetings after lunch in a room with no windows and really stuffy and having like my head bobbing and my eyelids just, you know, so drowsy. I was struggling to stay awake, and to the point where that first job, I worked for a law firm, and every so often somebody would come in and ask for one of us lowly paralegals to go and do some job of like photocopying or going to the courthouse. And I would be like, I would love to do that, you know, because I was so desperate to get up and move around so that I could wake up. So that definitely showed up, and drowsiness while I was driving definitely showed up. I had really intense morning headaches. And pretty much every day that would then get better through the day. I, like Bob, had the multiple bathroom trips at night. I was clenching and grinding my teeth. But I think because I didn't know that all of these things were symptoms of sleep apnea, I wasn't sharing those with my doctor. I would just go to the doctor in tears and say, I'm so overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. I am struggling to get up in the morning. I'm having such a tough time. And they would see the anxiety and depression. And because they didn't ask me anything about my sleep or these other symptoms, it just, you know, I just didn't get diagnosed for a long time. So I think my question for you, Sam, is just a little bit about why sleep apnea causes some of these symptoms, because it doesn't like sweating, like night sweats or high blood pressure. I think for a lot of people, they don't understand like why sleep apnea would cause those things. You know, Bob talked about that he wasn't snoring. I think I did snore, but I wasn't really aware of it. Like my husband was aware of it. So can you maybe just kind of talk us through this a little bit of like why these things show up with sleep apnea?
Yeah, great question. Classic symptoms and signs include the snoring, gasping for air during sleep. Those are probably the two main signs of sleep apnea, since nobody can kind of, well, gasping, you can say that's a symptom, but just witnessed irregular breathing patterns or witnessed breathing pauses by a bed partner, that's a sign. Snoring, that's a sign. These things may or may not be present in a person with obstructive sleep apnea, as we've clearly already mentioned today, because what really is snoring, first of all? Snoring is just a sound that's emitted from the person's throat when their airway is narrowed by their own anatomy or the structures in that person's throat. It's the relaxed tongue, the tissues in the upper airway space. When they get really relaxed, in the case of someone with sleep apnea, they get relaxed to the point that they obstruct or block the airway. Now, that sound of snoring as air is trying to squeeze through that tight space, every single throat is different. Every tongue is different. Every human was created differently. So just by the laws of physics, they can't all make the same sound when they get tight and air squeezes through them. So all that to say that snoring, while it's something that's so classically associated with sleep apnea and very often people consider it to be synonymous with sleep apnea, may not be present at all in a person with obstructive sleep apnea. And the same goes for witnessed irregular breathing patterns by a bed partner. I mean, first of all, it's nighttime. Your bed partner's asleep too. And not to mention that not everybody's witnessed irregular breathing patterns are going to be super obvious to the person right next to them. They may not have a loud snoring and then all of a sudden a quiet pause for 10 or 20 seconds and then back to loud snoring again. Like you said, if they're not snoring to begin with, then what are you really witnessing? Or it might just be harder to kind of determine if there's something irregular about that person's breathing from looking at them. So those are pretty much the signs, the classic signs of obstructive sleep apnea. And then in terms of symptoms, you know, more classically, the person with untreated sleep apnea is going to more often have difficulty with maintaining or with the maintenance of sleep, as opposed to the onset or initiation of sleep in the first part of the night. So essentially more trouble staying asleep as opposed to falling asleep. And it makes sense because naturally somebody who has not fallen asleep yet in the beginning of the night, they're not having apnea episodes yet. So that's not unlikely to cause that. But difficulty staying asleep, not necessarily every single apnea episode that a person experiences during sleep is going to cause an awakening, but very often it will. I always tell people, I'm not saying that every time you awaken is because you just had an apnea episode, but plenty of the awakenings that you're having are precipitated by apnea episodes. And those episodes or those awakenings can be associated with the gasp, or they can be completely spontaneous where a person just has no idea and they just keep on waking up. Or they might even wake up with that startled feeling or the feeling of palpitations or their heart racing because just before that, they were having an apnea episode and their oxygen fell down for a few seconds. So that's kind of the classic disruption to the nighttime sleep. And then, of course, we have the orphan symptoms of sleep apnea, like getting up to urinate a lot, like sweating a lot at nighttime, like kicking the legs during sleep or grinding the teeth during sleep, things that you can see don't clearly or directly correlate with respiratory or breathing issue, but really are just signs of sleep state instability. I mean, these are the ways in which our body is kind of expressing the fact that there's something wrong with the sleep and that the sleep is broken. And specifically with the urination, there are actually quite a few mechanisms that kind of drive that particular symptom in the setting of untreated sleep apnea.
That was going to be my question for you, Sam, is like, what causes that?
Yeah, so essentially, it's a few different things. Number one, with untreated sleep apnea, when a person is having untreated, first of all, the awakening itself. The urinary bladder would have to be pretty stretched and distended and full of urine for that to be the thing that awakens you. Very often what happens in the setting of untreated sleep apnea is the person is having awakenings and then upon awakening, noting urine in their bladder and saying, all right, well, I guess I have to pee, and that's what woke me up. And then they go to the bathroom and relieve themselves and go back to sleep. So I think that that's one thing that is important to keep in mind. But essentially, there is the release of something called atrial natriuretic peptide, or ANP, which is a diuretic hormone in the body that does precipitate more urination, that is secreted more often in the setting of apnea episodes or recurring apnea episodes throughout the nighttime. So that's one mechanism. Additionally, the same way that your airway is blocked during sleep and it's not allowing you to inhale properly, you're not really exhaling properly either. And that being the case, sometimes that air that is in our upper airway, or essentially the air that we're trying to expel, some of it ends up kind of resulting in a little bit of a pressure effect downward towards the urinary bladder, which kind of can produce that urge to want to urinate. So it's a couple of different things that drive that particular symptom. But I can tell you, just like Bob mentioned, it's one of those things, like many of these other symptoms, that do resolve with treatment of the sleep apnea.
So one of the other things, oftentimes this idea that it shows up as insomnia, which I think is partly what you're talking about, people waking up. And then it's kind of two things. It's like sometimes people have insomnia and sleep apnea that go together. So maybe you can speak a little bit about that and just also other sleep disorders and sleep apnea together. Like, do you see that in your patients? And does that make it really challenging?
Yes, yes, and yes. So essentially, as far as sleep apnea with insomnia, in fact, we have a term, COMISA, that stands for comorbid insomnia with sleep apnea. Very, very common. And it kind of makes sense in a lot of cases. Before I go any further, just to define, or just to kind of go over how we define insomnia in sleep medicine, we define insomnia as any difficulty falling asleep, any difficulty staying asleep, or early morning awakenings or waking up too early, or any combination of these three things. So that's how we define insomnia clinically. But in the setting of somebody with untreated sleep apnea, you can kind of look at that difficulty with staying asleep, which, like we said, is the insomnia pattern that's more common in untreated sleep apnea, as kind of two different ways. One is the kind of classic fragmented sleep pattern where the person just has a lot of wake up, back to sleep, wake up, back to sleep, wake up, back to sleep kind of pattern. And then you have the person who may awaken and then have a really prolonged window of wakefulness in the middle of the night that ends up cumulatively robbing them of sleep time, resulting in insufficient sleep in addition to their untreated sleep apnea. So one thing I think it's important is differentiating those two. But in the setting of somebody who, let's say, for example, was a pretty solid sleeper and then developed sleep apnea and then now starts to have that difficulty with staying asleep through the night and tons of awakenings, well, a new onset insomnia can be really frustrating, right? And to somebody who wasn't experiencing sleep difficulty like that. And that frustration, once it starts kicking in, and next thing you know, the person's thinking about it during the daytime and starting to anticipate sleep difficulties the next night. And next thing you know, you get into this kind of perpetual cycle of bedtime anxiety and nighttime anxiety. Now these awakenings that you're having are getting longer and longer and longer because you're just like, what the heck? Here we go again. Here's another night of, you know, poor sleep. And you have what really kind of classically looks like a stereotypical insomnia picture, really with just sleep apnea being the culprit underneath breaking the sleep.
Thanks for explaining that. So, Bob, I did want to ask you, is that something you relate to? Because I know, like me, you were waking up a bunch to use the bathroom. Mm-hmm. And then did you just go straight back to sleep before you were diagnosed?
Not really. My personality, no, my brain would start thinking about the next day. Like you said, that cycle would just, you know, be extremely frustrating. I mean, it really would. And again, I would just power through. And I think just the older you get, it's harder to do that. It catches up to you a little bit and it would just become more and more frustrating. So I think it's not like I'm not one of those people that could go to the bathroom, come back and just be out in a minute for sure. That wasn't me.
Are you facing sleep issues or a sleep disorder? Project Sleep is now excited to have the Sleep Helpline, a nonprofit-led free national helpline providing personalized support and resources. You can reach out today to speak with a compassionate resource specialist who will listen and help provide accurate sleep disorders information, resources to help navigate daily living and the healthcare landscape, and connect you with a certified sleep center and patient support organizations. Contact the Sleep Helpline at 1-800-819-2043 or by filling out a form on our website at project-sleep.com.
So lower libido and erectile dysfunction, Sam, like I know that that's something we definitely are not talking about enough, but do you see that in your patients and how is that related to sleep apnea?
Very often, definitely, we do see that. And I think that that also speaks to what you were mentioning a little while ago about kind of the effects that untreated sleep apnea can have on the person's mood. I think that's definitely a big part of this, because a lot of people who experience untreated sleep apnea may not have those classic symptoms, but might have these other mood-related symptoms, like more of a depressed mood or just feeling more anxious, more irritable during the daytime. And in addition to that, sexual desire, lower, reduced libido or erectile dysfunction is definitely something that can accompany symptoms like that.
I feel like Bob touched on the high blood pressure part of it. Did you want to talk a little bit about why there's a link with sleep apnea?
Definitely. You know, with sleep apnea, going back to the definition as somebody who's having a lot of recurring apnea episodes during sleep, well, these apnea episodes, which are typically anywhere between 10 to 30 seconds long, sometimes can be longer in more severe cases, they're characterized by, like we said, not only a pause or a lack of breathing, but also a subsequent drop in oxygen. Now, our body doesn't like it when oxygen falls, and our brain reacts very quickly to that. As soon as it detects that our oxygen is dropping while we're asleep, there's a little kind of a cascade of stress reactions that occur in response to that drop in oxygen. And one of those things is the vasculature or the blood vessels in our body that essentially control our blood pressure. Each time oxygen falls for a few seconds, they kind of squeeze and constrict in response to that drop in oxygen. And this recurring drop in oxygen all throughout the nighttime, dozens and dozens of times, causing those blood vessels to keep on squeezing and constricting and getting tight and increasing pressure. Overall, or over time, if it's not treated and we just leave it for prolonged periods of time, those vessels will permanently become relatively more constricted and more tight, resulting in high blood pressure, which is probably the most common cardiovascular complication of untreated sleep apnea. And one thing that we see a lot in sleep medicine clinic is people who have high blood pressure and sleep apnea never treat their sleep apnea, or sleep apnea is never addressed. And by the time they're in their 60s, 70s, or 80s, they're on 3, 4, sometimes even 5 blood pressure pills. Because as long as the blood pressure is so erratic at nighttime during sleep, that's going to translate to more difficulty stabilizing blood pressure during the daytime as well.
Another thing I'm wondering, I don't think you mentioned this, Bob, but sometimes people also are dealing with cognitive issues. So problems with their, was that something that you dealt with, Bob, or not really? Like
not,
difficulty
not
with
really.
Word I mean, finding or like remembering things?
Not that I can pinpoint, really. I mean, I've heard that and I've read about that and I can see why that is a factor. Yeah, not for me. Not that I can pinpoint. Like it might have happened, but I would not knowing anything about sleep apnea.
Right.
You don't know. You just think it's like, oh, I didn't sleep great. I'm a little foggy today. I mean, I might have went through stretches where it was a factor. I just, you know, kind of powered through.
It seems like you power through a lot over there.
Yeah, well, that's the mentality, which can get you far and can also hurt you too.
And so, Sam, I'm just wondering, like, have you seen that show up in your patients, and what kind of things would people be looking for if there was like some sort of cognitive issue? Like, would it be like word finding and memory? Like, what kind of things do you see in your patients?
Probably it would say brain fog, kind of like you were just saying a moment ago, just feeling foggy during the day, not as sharp, not at your normal level of sharpness, despite however well we're able to push through. Because you make a really good point that, you know, as human beings, we adapt to feeling a certain way because mm-hmm. we got to get our stuff done. We know we have our responsibilities, our bills, our work, our family. So all that to say that brain fog or cognitive fog during the daytime is definitely something that we see commonly with sleep apnea. And then over time, you know, there's a lot of data kind of demonstrating long-term cognitive issues associated with untreated sleep apnea, things like an increased risk for dementia. And this is something that we're still learning a lot about. We're learning a lot about, or we know already a lot about, the role of rapid eye movement sleep, that deeper stage of sleep where our brain does a lot of its taking out the trash, for lack of a better word, clearing plaques that would otherwise result in formation of plaques and dementia later on. If we have untreated sleep apnea, we're not getting as much REM sleep as we should be getting, or as much as our brain requires. So that's the association with prolonged period, or leaving sleep apnea untreated for prolonged periods of time, resulting in increased risk for dementia.
Thank you for explaining that. So I had this thing that I just kind of wanted to get everybody's input on. So there was this silly video on Instagram that went amazingly viral of this guy. He's called Cowphobia86. And I don't know if you saw this, but he was like drinking out of his humidifier chamber. Did you see that? It was gross. Anyway, the point being, it was so viral that I think 35 million people viewed it or something. So I was really interested to read a lot of those comments because I think it gives you a really good idea about where the public is and what their perceptions of who has sleep apnea and who doesn't. And it was pretty depressing reading, but I wanted to get onto this topic of weight. And, you know, I know that BMI is this risk factor for sleep apnea, but I think there's this misconception in the public that sleep apnea is purely caused by people being overweight or obese. And there's a lot of these comments, of course, they're really unkind because it's on social media, but there's a lot of comments on that video saying he just needs to lose weight. If he, you know, lost weight, he wouldn't have sleep apnea anymore. So I was hoping, Sam, that you could give us some sort of idea of how to think about that, about, you know, we know that weight is a factor with sleep apnea, but, you know, like, should, you know, how do we change that perception? Like, and just what are your thoughts about that?
Super important point. You know, I think it's important. The way I always talk about it when I lecture and talk to patients is there's one cause of obstructive sleep apnea, one singular cause, and that's having narrow throat anatomy. Now, it just so happens that obstructive sleep apnea is common, not synonymous with, but common in the setting of overweight and obesity, because a lot of people with overweight and obesity have extra fat tissue stored in their neck. And it's that extra fat tissue that impinges on the airway and makes that airway pipe much more narrow and much more likely to get blocked by a relaxed tongue and relaxed throat at nighttime. However, I can introduce you to dozens and dozens and dozens of people with overweight and obesity that do not have sleep apnea, and plenty of people, obviously, like we always talk about, that do not qualify or do not fit overweight or obesity by their body mass index and have horrible sleep apnea because they have a smaller throat, or they have a thicker tongue, or they have a more recessed or smaller micrognathic or retrognathic jaw, or any combination of these anatomical features that just result in having a smaller airway or a smaller throat at nighttime. So going back to what we just said, it's one singular cause, narrow throat anatomy. Just so happens to be narrow in the case of many people with overweight and obesity because of excess fat, but common as well in people who do not have overweight or obesity because of their anatomy that predisposes them to have.
Yeah, I'm super interested, Bob, in your take, just because as a former professional athlete, tell me about, like, what did you think about this diagnosis? And, you know, what do you hear from people around you about when you tell them that you have sleep apnea?
Well, first of all, it's interesting to me. I hear BMI thrown around, and I'm kind of in the minority that I think it's just a useless number, personally, just because for athletes, at least, because BMI, I mean, if you look at my BMI, I'm so obese, but meanwhile, I'm 10% body fat. So it's like, I think you have to put it in a different, but for the masses of people in the population, I get why it's used. I think for me, just like the stereotypes and everything like that, nothing, I mean, you get to a certain age where it doesn't really bother you. I'm just doing what's best for my health and for me and, right, you know, my family, but I can see the stigma around things. I think the biggest thing, and that's why Project Sleep is so important, is getting simple information out to people, because like I said earlier, I do my due diligence, and it's hard. The medical system in the U.S., at least, I can talk about the U.S., makes it very difficult to get diagnosed with OSA. It's not easy. Like, to get an appointment with Dr. Kashani, I'm sure it takes forever. I mean, it took me 9 months to try to get an appointment with a pulmonologist, and I knew them. But primary care, I was lucky enough that my primary care doc actually knew something about sleep medicine, and he was able to take me through the process quickly. But for a lot of people out there, they'll say, like you said, the anxiety, the teeth grinding. I mean, there are two other things I dealt with too. It just, they'll say, here's an antidepressant, take that for about a few months and see if you feel better. They don't even think about your sleep kind of hygiene. So that's kind of frustrating in a lot of ways for me, because when I talk to people and let them know, because I didn't know the first thing about sleep apnea when I first was diagnosed, I really didn't know. It was not an area where I even knew anything about, but like I said, I've done my due diligence and kind of researched it and understand it hell of a lot more now. I guess my point being, it's really difficult to get solid medical advice in the U.S. around sleep apnea. I mean, that's why I was excited to have Dr. Kashani. It's somebody for me just to know now, and I can just shoot him an email and I'll be like, hey, just because it's so difficult to get in with specialists in any type of specialty, really. And once you do, they're overwhelmed the way I'm not going to go on my tangent about the medical stuff. I've been working in pharma and life sciences for 20 years now, but it can be very hard to get that one-on-one care because sleep apnea is it's complex, like doctor explained. And so there's so many different types of people and what it could be. And they just, you know, and then if you do get a machine, it's depending on the clinic or person you see, it could just be like they show up your doorstep and figure it out. And that's what happened to me. So I understand why it goes undiagnosed because people don't want to be bothered. And at least there's home tests now that have gotten better at least.
Yeah.
In lab studies are the best, obviously the gold standard, but at least there's options to kind of see
how much do you think, Bob, that you were in a position where you had to advocate for yourself to get the diagnosis?
I mean, 100% was all me. I mean, like I said, I'm friendly with a couple of pulmonologists through a former job I had, and I was lucky enough to text them and just ask them some questions. But other than that, you go to a primary care doc. And if it wasn't for him suggesting, like, oh, yeah, I mentioned the sleep study to him. He's like, oh, yeah, maybe that would help. I'm like, oh, no, I want one. Like, I want to do one. I'll pay cash. I don't really care. Because they were curious about, because it has to be covered, like the insurance. And I was like, listen, I'll just pay out of pocket. I just want to get it done. Just to see, just curious. And I did. And it's not like I was a severe case. I was a mild case, but even mild can be, it's classified as mild, but it still can be pretty serious. And so it was, you have to be your own advocate in any type of health. I mean, knowing the health system like I do, because I work in it too, you really do. You have to ask the right questions. You have to bring it, like you said, you didn't know that it could be related to sleep. And you just have to throw it all out there. And hopefully, you know, I always say, if your doctor is not helping you in a way that you think, there's plenty of doctors out there. Find a new one.
I think there are
ones out there that are great.
Yeah, for sure. I think that my experience was definitely having to, in the end, like I really had to advocate for myself because I was kind of going to doctors and explaining, you know, I really think like for those 10 years, a lot of the time I was just crying and having anxiety and depression. But towards the end of those 10 years, I really started thinking there's something wrong with my sleep. Like I wouldn't be this sleepy during the day if there weren't. And so for me, it did really, I think just knowing what I know now, just knowing that there are, I think a lot of the public don't know that there are board certified sleep specialists. So I think just knowing to ask for a referral to a board certified sleep specialist would have really helped me. And so I would love people out there to, you know, like know about that. So Sam, is that something that you come across within your practice?
Definitely. And not only amongst people, but even amongst clinicians that are not sleep physicians, whether primary doctors or other specialties, many of them don't know that there are sleep medicine providers like myself that practice exclusively sleep medicine and treat all sleep disorders, whether it's something pulmonary or respiratory like apnea versus something behavioral like insomnia versus something neurologic like hypersomnia. So all that to say that I think you're right. It just demonstrates a significant lack of awareness, not only in the general community, but if our primary doctors or our doctors that we're, you know, presenting to with our symptoms and concerns related to our sleep are not, you know, thinking about sleep apnea just because my BMI is low, for example, or I don't exhibit, you know, all the classic signs and symptoms. Well, as long as there's these barriers with, you know, getting your work up, then like you said, it's just going to continue to be a big problem that remains underdiagnosed.
Yeah. I wondered if, Sam, could we just go back really quick to make sure for anybody listening at home, the symptoms that we talked about, are there particular symptoms that people with central sleep apnea would look for versus obstructive sleep apnea? Just wanted to kind of cover that before we wrap up.
Good question. The simple answer is not really, just because really the symptoms between the two types of sleep apnea are very similar. Now, in terms of signs, snoring and witnessed breathing pauses or witnessed pauses in breathing, well, really, I should just say snoring. Snoring is something that, like we said, is the sound of an obstructed throat. So for that reason, somebody with classically with central sleep apnea and only central sleep apnea would not have snoring. But it doesn't help that a lot of people have both obstructive and central, what's called mixed obstructive and central sleep apnea. They may have symptoms classically of sleep apnea. They may also snore, but then you do a sleep study on them and they also have central sleep apnea. But snoring would probably be the one that stands out as a difference suggestive of obstructive versus central.
Okay, well, thank you so much for explaining that. So I did want to just share with everybody tuning in that We do have like a number of different nonprofits in this space. So in the United States, we have the Alliance of Sleep Apnea Partners. They have recently done some work around the Philips CPAP recall. So if you're affected by that, you might want to check that out. There's also the American Sleep Apnea Association, and they have a program where you can donate lightly used CPAPs and, you know, any unused masks or CPAP equipment to them. And there's also the Reggie White Foundation that does a similar thing to that. So in our toolkit, you'll see information about how to contact those. There's also a bunch of different organizations outside of the US that people in different countries, there are a lot of different places where you can get support in your own country. And then I also wanted just to list a few helpful resources for people. There are so many Facebook groups out there, and I think they vary a lot. Like there's probably some wonderful US-based ones, but the one that I send people to the most is Hope to Sleep is a charity in the United Kingdom. They just have an excellent Facebook group where they have a lot of patients in there and clinicians and really well-educated people. And it's extremely well moderated. So I feel like there's no misinformation and it's just a really great resource. Also from the Alliance of Sleep Apnea Partners, they have a really good PDF that we're talking about trying to get more people diagnosed, especially for women. There's a PDF you can download that has how symptoms sometimes show up differently in women. And on the other side, it has a bunch of information for primary care physicians. So that's something that I physically take to the doctor with me to give them. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention my own podcast, but I finished up my Sleep Apnea Stories podcast last month. But there are 143 free episodes still on every podcast platform. And another podcast that's still going on is from the American Sleep Apnea Association. It's called Awake. And you can find that wherever you get podcasts. And so, yeah, Project Sleep Apnea Education and Awareness Program is generously funded by donors just like you and also by sponsors, including Lilly and ApneaMed. So we just wanted to give them a shout out. And thank you all for tuning in. This has been really fun. A PDF toolkit will be coming soon. So in order to make sure you hear about that, you're going to want to go and sign up for e-updates on the Project Sleep website, which is project-sleep.com. If you want to, we'd love it if you use the hashtag Sleep Apnea Squad. And as you're posting about your life living with sleep apnea, and we'd love to see that and be able to reshare things. Thank you so much to our wonderful guests, Bob and Sam. I really appreciate you guys taking part.
The Project Sleep Podcast is produced by Carver Sound Productions. For more information on podcast production services, visit carversoundproductions.com.